Greetings, listeners. We're back once again to talk to you about the Cthulhu mythos, its books, its monsters, its unfortunate human casualties, its timeline in general, and even its tangential bits like the dreamlands, or things of a weird nature, or things that are Lovecraftian leaning. Weird fiction, science fiction, horror, learn of terrible meetings in lonely places, of cyclopean ruins and vast staircases that lead down to abysses of nighted secrets, of complex angles that lead through invisible walls to other regions of space and time, and of hideous explorations in remote and forbidden places, on other worlds, and in different time-space continua. From the creation of our galaxy to the death of the sun, this is an exploration of the Cthulhu mythos from the perspective of humans' concept of history. We are the people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos. You can find us at pgttcm.com, pgttcm.podbean.com, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos starts now.
The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Season 8.
Greetings and welcome to The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. I am your host, D.B. Spitzer. And between episodes, let's see, 107 and 134, we will be talking about The Beetle. The Beetle, a Mystery, is a 1897 horror novel by British writer Richard Marsh. To tell you about it is to spoil it. So check it out, and that'll be going on from now until sometime in December. This episode is brought to you by FoundOutOnClothing.com and BunnySlippers.com. Subscribe to PGTTCM with D.B. Spitzer and Seraphie. Wherever you subscribe to podcasts, we prefer Podbean and Apple Podcasts. Check out the new website over at pgttcm.com and check out the merch table over at pgttcm.threadless.com. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at pgttcm, or check us out on YouTube at People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, edited by Daniel Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod, featuring The Hive, Ghost Story, Ghost Processional, Oppressive Gloom, and our theme song, The Chamber.
Chapter 40, What Miss Coleman Saw Through the Window. As Miss Coleman had paused, as if her narrative was approaching a conclusion, I judged it expedient to make an attempt to bring the record as quickly as possible up to date. I take it, Miss Coleman, that you have observed what has occurred in the house today? She tightened her nutcracker jaws and glared at me disdainfully. Her dignity was ruffled. I'm coming to it, aren't I? If you'll let me. If you've got no manners, I'll learn you some. One doesn't like to be hurried at my time of life, young man. I was meekly silent. Plainly, if she was to talk, everyone else must listen. During the last few days, there have been some queer goings-on over the road. Out of the common queer, I mean, for goodness knows that they always have been queer enough. That Arab party has been flitting about like a creature possessed. I've seen him going in and out 20 times a day. This morning, she paused, to fix her eyes on Lessingham. She apparently observed his growing interest as she approached the subject which had brought us there, and resented it. Don't look at me like that, young man, because I won't have it. And as for questions, I may answer questions when I'm done, but don't you dare to ask me one before, because I won't be interrupted. Up to then, Lessingham had not spoken a word, but it seemed as if she was endowed with the faculty of perceiving the huge volume of the words which he had left unuttered. This morning, as I've said already, she glanced at Lessingham as if she defied his contradiction. When that Arab party came home, it was just on the stroke of 7. I know what was the exact time because, when I went to the door to the milkman, my clock was striking the half hour, and I always keep it 30 minutes fast. As I was taking the milk, the man said to me, "Hello, Miss Coleman. Here's your friend coming along." "What friend?" I says. for I ain't got no friends as I know, round here, nor yet I hope no enemies neither. And I looks round, and there was the Arab party coming tearing down the road, his bedcover thing all flying in the wind, and his arms straight out in front of him. I never did see anyone go at such a pace. My goodness, I says, I wonder he don't do himself an injury. I wonder someone else don't do him an injury, says the milkman. The very sight of him is enough to make my milk go sour. And he picked up his pail and went away quite grumpy. Though what the Arab party's done to him is more than I can say. I have always noticed that milkman's temper's short like his measure. I wasn't best pleased with him for speaking of that Arab party as my friend, which he never has been and never won't be, and never could be neither. 5 persons went to the house after the milkman was gone, and that there Arab party was safe inside. 3 of them was commercials that I know, because afterwards they came to me. But of course, they none of them got no chance with that there Arab party except of hammering at his front door, which ain't what you might call a paying game, nor nice for the temper, but for that I don't blame him. For if once those commercials do begin talking, they'll talk forever. Now, I'm coming to this afternoon. I thought it was about time, though for the life of me I did not dare to hint as much. Well, it might have been 3, or it might have been 3:30. Anyhow, it was thereabouts when up there comes 2 men and a woman, which one of the men was that young man what's a friend of yours. Oh, I says to myself, here's something new in callers. I wonder what it is they're wanting. That young man what was a friend of yours, he starts hammering and hammering, as the custom was with everyone who came. And, as usual, no more notice was taken of him than nothing. Though I knew at the time the Arab party was indoors. At this point, I felt that at all hazards I must interpose a question. You are sure he was indoors? She took it better than I feared she might. Of course I'm sure. Hadn't I seen him come in at 7? And he never hadn't gone out since. For I don't believe that I'd taken my eyes off the place not for 2 minutes together, and I'd never had a sight of him. If he wasn't indoors, where was he then? For the moment, so far as I was concerned, the query was unanswerable. She triumphantly continued. Instead of doing what most did, when they'd had enough of hammering and going away, these 3 went round to the back, and I'm blessed if they mustn't have got through the kitchen window, woman and all, for all of a sudden the blind in the front room was pulled not up, but down. Dragged down it was. And there was that young man, what's a friend of yours, standing with it in his hand. Well, I says to myself, if that ain't cool, I should like to know what is. If when you ain't let in, you can let yourself in, and that without so much as saying by your leave or with your leave, things is coming to a pretty pass. Wherever can that Arab party be, and whatever can he be thinking of, to let them go on like that because that he's the sort to allow liberty to be took with him, and say nothing? I don't believe. Every moment I expects to hear a noise and see a row begin, but so far as I could make out, all was quiet, and there wasn't nothing of the kind. So I says to myself, there's more in this than meets the eye, and them 3 parties must have right upon their side, or they wouldn't be doing what they're doing in the way they are. There'd be a shindy. Presently, in about 5 minutes, the front door opens, and a young man, not the one what's your friend, but the other, comes sailing out and through the gate, and down the road as stiff and upright as a grenadier. I'd never seen anyone walk more upright, and few as fast. At his heels comes the young man, what is your friend, and it seems to me that he could make out what this other was a-doing of. I says to myself, there's been a quarrel between them two, and him as has gone has hooked it. This young man, what is your friend, he stood at the gate, all of a fidget, staring after the other with all his eyes, as if he couldn't think what to make of him. And the young woman, she stood on the doorstep, staring after him too. As the young man, what had hooked it, turned the corner, and was out of sight, all at once your friend, he seemed to make up his mind, and he started off running as hard as he could pelt, and the young woman was left alone. I expected every minute to see him come back with the other young man, and the young woman, by the way, she hung about the gate, she seemed to expect it too. But no, nothing of the kind. So when, as I expect, she had enough of waiting, she went into the house again, and I see her pass the front room window. After a while, back she comes to the gate, and stands looking and looking, but nothing was to be seen of either of them young men. When she'd been at the gate, I dare say 5 minutes, back she goes into the house. And I never saw nothing of her again. You never saw anything of her again? Are you sure she went back into the house? As sure as I am that I see you. I suppose that you didn't keep a constant watch upon the premises. But that's just what I do. I felt something queer was going on, and I made up my mind to see it through. And when I make up my mind to do a thing like that, I'm not easy to turn aside. I never moved off the chair at my bedroom window, and I never took my eyes off the house, not till you come knocking at my front door. But since the young lady is certainly not in the house at present, she must have eluded your observation, and in some manner have left it without you seeing her. I don't believe she did. I don't see how she could have done. There's something queer about that house since the Arab party's been inside it. But though I didn't see her, I did see someone else. Who was that? A young man. A young man? Yes, a young man, and that's what puzzled me. And what's been puzzling me ever since, for see him go in I never did do. Can you describe him? Not as to the face, for he wore a dirty cloth cap pulled down right over it, and he walked so quickly that I never had a proper look. But I should know him anywhere if I saw him, if only because of his clothes and his walk. What was there peculiar about his clothes and his walk? Why, his clothes were that old and torn and dirty that a ragman wouldn't have given a thank you for them. And as for fit, there wasn't none. They hung upon him like a scarecrow. He was a regular figure of fun. I should think the boys would call after him if they saw him in the street. As for his walk, he walked off just like the first young man had done. He strutted along with his shoulders back and his head in the air, and that stiff and straight that my kitchen poker would have looked crooked beside of him. Did nothing happen to attract your attention between the young lady's going back into the house and the coming of this young man? Miss Coleman cogitated. Now you mention it, there did, though I should have forgotten all about it if you hadn't asked me. That comes of your not letting me to tell you the tale my own way. About 20 minutes after the young woman had gone in, someone put up the blind in the front room, which that young man had dragged right down. I couldn't see who it was, for the blind was between us, and it was about 10 minutes after that young man came marching out. And then what followed? Why, in about another 10 minutes, that Arab party himself comes scooting through the door. The Arab party? Yes, the Arab party. The sight of him took me clean aback. Where he'd been and what he'd been doing with himself while them there people played high spy high about his premises, I'd have given a shilling out of my pocket to have known. But there he was, as large as life, and carrying a bundle. A bundle? A bundle on his head, like a muffin man carries his tray. It was a great thing. You never would have thought he could have carried it. And it was easy to see that it was as much as he could manage. It bent him nearly double, and he went crawling along like a snail. It took him quite a time to get to the end of the road. Mr. Lessingham leaped up from his seat, crying, "Marjorie was in that bundle." "I doubt it," I said. He moved about the room distractedly, wringing his hands. "She was. She must have been. God help us all." "I repeat that I doubt it. If you will be advised by me, you will wait a while before you arrive at any such conclusion." All at once, there was a tapping at the window pane. Atherton was staring at us from without. He shouted through the glass, "Come out of that, you fossils! I've news for you!" End of chapter 40. Chapter 41. The Constable, His Clue, and the Cab. Miss Coleman got up in a fluster, went hurrying to the door. "I won't have that young man in my house. I won't have him. Don't let him dare to put his nose across my doorstep." I endeavored to appease her perturbation. "I promise you that he shall not come in, Miss Coleman. My friend here and I will go and speak to him outside." She held the front door open just wide enough to enable Lessingham and me to slip through. Then she shut it after us with a bang. She evidently had a strong objection to any intrusion on Sydney's part. Standing without the gate, he saluted us with a characteristic vigor which was scarcely flattering to our late hostess. Behind him was a constable. "I hope you two have been mewed in with that old pussy long enough. While you've been tittle-tattling, I've been doing. Listen to what this Bobby's got to say." The constable, his thumbs thrust inside his belt, wore an indulgent smile upon his countenance. He seemed to find Sidney amusing. He spoke in a deep bass voice as if it issued from his boots. "I don't know that I've got anything to say." It was plain that Sidney thought otherwise. "You wait till I've given this pretty pair of gossips a lead, officer, then I'll trot you out." He turned to us. "After I'd poked my nose into every dashed hole in that infernal den, and been rewarded with nothing but a pain in the back for my trouble, I stood cooling my heels on the doorstep, wondering if I shouldn't fight the cabman, or get him to fight me just to pass the time away. For he says he can box, and he looks it. When who should come strolling along but this magnificent example of the Metropolitan Constabulary?" He waved his hand towards the policeman, whose grin grew wider. I looked at him, and he looked at me, and then we'd had enough of admiring each other's fine features and striking proportions. He said to me, "Has he gone?" I said, "Who? Baxter? Or Bob Brown?" He said, "No, the Arab." I said, "What do you know about any Arab?" He said, "Well, I saw him in the Broadway about 3/4 of an hour ago, and then seeing you here and the house all open, I wonder if he had gone for good." With that, I almost jumped out of my skin, though you can bet your life I never showed it. I said, "How do you know it was he?" He said, "It was him right enough. There's no doubt about that. If you've seen him once, you're not likely to forget him. Where was he going?" "He was talking to a cabman, four-wheeler. He'd got a great bundle on his head, wanted to take it inside with him. Cabman didn't seem to see it." That was enough for me. I picked this most deserving officer up in my arms and carried him across the road to you two fellows like a flash of lightning. Since the policeman was 6'3" or 6'4" and more than sufficiently broad in proportion, his scarcely seemed the kind of figure to be picked up in anybody's arms and carried like a flash of lightning, which, as his smile grew more indulgent, he himself appeared to think. Still, even allowing for Atherton's exaggeration, the news which he had brought was sufficiently important. I questioned the constable upon my own account. "This is my card, officer. Probably, before the day is over, a charge of very serious character will be preferred against the person who has been residing in the house over the way. In the meantime, it is of the utmost importance that a watch should be kept upon his movements. I suppose you have no sort of doubt that the person you saw in the Broadway was the one in question?" "Not a morsel. I know him as well as I do my own brother. We all do upon this beat. He's known amongst us as the Arab. I've had my eye on him ever since he came to the place. A queer fish he is. I always have said that he's up to some game or other. I never came across one like him for flying about in all sorts of weather, at all hours of the night, always tearing along as if for his life. As I was telling this gentleman, I saw him in the Broadway. Well, now it's about an hour since, perhaps a little more. I was coming on duty when I saw a crowd in front of the district railway station. And there was the Arab, having a sort of argument with the cabman. He had a great bundle on his head, 5 or 6 feet long, perhaps longer. He wanted to take this great bundle with him into the cab. And the cabman, he didn't see it." "You didn't wait to see him drive off?" "No, I hadn't time. I was due at the station. I was cutting it pretty fine as it was." "You didn't speak to him or to the cabman?" "No, it wasn't any business of mine, you understand. The whole thing just caught my eye as I was passing."
"And you didn't take the cabman's number?"
"No. Well, as far as that goes, it wasn't needful. I know the cabman, his name and all about him. His stable's in Bradmore." I whipped out my notebook. "Give me his address. I don't know what his Christian name is. Tom, I believe, but I'm not sure. Anyhow, his surname's Ellis, and his address is Church Mews Street, St. John's Road, Bradmore. I don't know his number, but anyone will tell you which is his place if you ask for Four-Wheel Ellis. That's the name he's known by among his pals because of his driving a four-wheeler. Thank you, officer. I'm obliged to you." Two half crowns changed hands. "If you will keep an eye on the house and advise me at the address which you will find on my card, of anything which takes place there during the next few days, you will do me a service." We had clambered back into the hansom. The driver was just about to start when the constable was struck by a sudden thought. "One moment, sir. Blessed if I wasn't going to forget the most important bit of all. I did hear him tell Alice where to drive him to. He kept saying it over and over again in that queer lingo of his. Waterloo Railway Station. Waterloo Railway Station. All right, said Alice. I'll drive you to Waterloo Railway Station right enough. Only I'm not going to have that bundle of yours inside my cab. There isn't room for it, so you put it on the roof. To Waterloo Railway Station, said the Arab. I take my bundle with me to Waterloo Railway Station. I take it with me. Who says you don't take it with you? Said Ellis. You can take it and 20 more besides for all I care, only you don't take it inside my cab. Put it on the roof. I take it with me to Waterloo Railway Station, said the Arab. And there they were, wrangling and jangling, and neither seeming to be able to make out what the other was after, and the people all laughing. Waterloo Railway Station, you are sure that was what he said? I'll take my oath to it, because I said to myself when I heard it, I wonder what you'll have to pay for that little lot for the district railway stations outside the 4 mile radius. As we drove off, I was inclined to ask myself a little bitterly, and perhaps unjustly, if it were not characteristic of the average London policeman to almost forget the most important part of his information, at any rate to leave it to the last and only to bring it to the front on having his palm crossed with silver. As the hansom bowled along, we three had what occasionally approached a warm discussion. Marjorie was in that bundle, began Lessingham, in the most lugubrious of tones, and with the most woebegone of faces. I doubt it, I observed. She was, I feel it, I know it. She was either dead and mutilated, or gagged and drugged and helpless. All that remains is vengeance. I repeat that I doubt it. Atherton struck in. I am bound to say, with the best will in the world to think otherwise, that I agree with Lessingham. You are wrong. It's all very well for you to talk in that cocksure way, but it's easier for you to say I'm wrong than to prove it. If I am wrong, and if Lessingham's wrong, how do you explain his extraordinary insistence on taking it inside the cab with him, which the bobby describes? If there wasn't something horrible, awful in that bundle of his, of which he feared the discovery, why was he so reluctant to have it placed upon the roof? There probably was something inside which he was particularly anxious should not be discovered, but I doubt if it was anything of the kind which you suggest. Here is Marjorie in a house alone. Nothing has been said of her since. Her clothing, her hair, is found hidden away under the floor. This scoundrel sallies forth with a huge bundle on his head. The bobby speaks of it being 5 or 6 feet long or longer. A bundle which he regards with so much solicitude that he insists on never allowing it to go for a single instant out of his sight and reach. What is in the thing? Don't all the facts most unfortunately point in one direction? Mr. Lessingham covered his face with his hands and groaned. I fear that Mr. Atherton is right. I differ from you both. Sidney at once became heated. Then perhaps you can tell us what was in the bundle. I fancy I could make a guess at the contents. Well, you could you? Then perhaps, for our sakes, you'll make it, and not play the oracular owl. Lessingham and I are interested in this business, after all. It contained the bearer's personal property. That and nothing more. Stay, before you jeer at me, suffer me to finish. If I am not mistaken as to the identity of the person whom the constable describes as the Arab, I apprehend that the contents of that bundle were of much more importance to him than if they had consisted of Miss Linden, either dead or living. More, I am inclined to suspect that if the bundle was placed on the roof of the cab, and if the driver did meddle with it, and he did find out the contents and understand them, he would have been driven out of hand, stark staring mad. Sidney was silent, as if he reflected. I imagine he perceived that there was something in what I said. But what has become of Miss Linden? I fancy that Miss Linden at this moment is somewhere. I don't, just now, know exactly where, but I hope very shortly to be able to give you a clear notion. Attired in a rotten, dirty pair of boots, a filthy, tattered pair of trousers, a ragged, unwashed apology for a shirt, a greasy, ancient, shapeless coat, and a frowsy, peaked cloth cap. They stared at me, open-eyed. Atherton was the first to speak. What on earth do you mean? I mean that it seems to me that the facts point in the direction of my conclusions rather than yours, and that very strongly, too. Miss Coleman asserts that she saw Miss London return into the house. that within a few minutes the blind was replaced at the front window, and that shortly after a young man, attired in the costume I have described, came walking out of the front door. I believe that young man was Miss Marjorie Linden. Lessingham and Atherton both broke out into interrogations, with Sydney as usual loudest. But man alive, what on earth should make her do a thing like that? Marjorie, the most retiring, modest girl on all God's earth, walk about in broad daylight in such a costume, and for no reason at all? My dear Champnell, you are suggesting that she first of all went mad. She was in a state of trance. Good God, Champnell. Well? Then you think that juggling villain did get hold of her? Undoubtedly. Here's my view of the case. Mind, it's only a hypothesis, and you must take it for what it's worth. It seems to me quite clear that the Arab, as we will call the person for the sake of identification, was somewhere about the premises when you thought he wasn't. But where? We looked upstairs and downstairs and everywhere. Where could he have been? That, as at present advised, I am not prepared to say, but I think you may take it for granted that he was there. He hypnotized the man Holt, and sent him away intending you to go after him, and so being rid of you both. The deuce he did, Champnell! You write me down an ass! As soon as the coast was clear, he discovered himself to Miss Linden, who, I expect, was disagreeably surprised and hypnotized her. The hound! The devil! The first exclamation was Lessingham's, the second Sydney's. He then constrained her to strip herself to the skin. The wretch! The fiend! He cut off her hair. He hid it and her clothes under the floor where we found them, where I think it probable that he had already some ancient masculine garments concealed. By Jove! I shouldn't be surprised if they were Holt's. I remember the man saying that the nice joker stripped him of his duds. And certainly when I saw him, and when Marjorie found him, he had absolutely nothing on but a queer sort of cloak. Can it be possible that the humorous professor of hanky-panky, may all the maledictions of the accursed alight upon his head, can have sent Marjorie Linden, the daintiest damsel in the land, into the streets of London, rigged out in Holt's old togs? As to that, I am not able to give an authoritative opinion, but if I understand you aright, it at least is possible. Anyhow, I am disposed to think that he sent Miss Linden after the man Holt, taking it for granted that he had eluded you. That's it. Write me down an ass again. Then he did elude you. You have yourself admitted. That's because I stopped talking with that mutton-headed Bobby. I'd have followed the man to the ends of the earth if it hadn't been for that. Precisely. The reason is immaterial. It is the fact with which we are immediately concerned. He did elude you, and I think you will find that Miss Linden and Mr. Holt are together at this moment. In men's clothing? Both in men's clothing, or rather Miss Linden in a man's rags. Great Potiphar! To think of Marjorie like that! And where are they? And where they are, the Arab is not very far off either. Lessingham caught me by the arm. And what diabolical mischief do you imagine that he proposes to do to her? I shirked the question. Whatever it is our business to prevent his doing it. And where do you think they have been taken? That, it will be our immediate business to endeavor to discover. And here, at any rate, we are at Waterloo. End of chapter 41.